Okay, so again, thank you for the generous invite. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about a couple papers, one that came out about last May and one that's in progress, and I keep saying it's going to come out next week, but hopefully in the next couple weeks it will actually come out. This was work done in collaboration with Per Berglund at UNH, Eric Gimon, who's a postdoc at Berkeley, and Vijay, who is of course at Penn. So the basic motivation for this work, or the why should you care part, is, as Samir said, this offers a promising approach to the black hole information paradox. Although, as Steve said, of course, we'd eventually like to move towards more realistic geometries. So up until now, basically, only geometries for two charged microstates have been found, although a couple very specialized three charged microstates were found, basically by generalizing some of these two charge systems. And classically, these geometries have vanishing horizon area. Now, if you put in stringy corrections, those geometries do get a finite horizon area. It's a small horizon. And you can calculate the entropy there and show that it matches. But still, we'd like to find geometries or microstates for geometries that have finite horizons for the black hole and also could be potential microstates for the new black ring solutions that people like Gary and Henriette and Harvey have found. And I'd also like to find, by doing this, geometries that could be microstates for four-charge or more-charge four-dimensional black holes. You'd like to connect this old picture of deep brain stain counting with the new fuzzball picture. So what I mean by that is sort of one of the famous things about string theory is that you can predict the entropy of various black holes. This was originally done by Strominger and Vafa a number of years ago. And this was done by calculating, or by counting microstates in some conformal field theory, basically by arranging various bound states of D1 and D5 brains, or various duality frames of that, and counting the number of ways you could do that, basically by extrapolating the central charge of that CFT. So that looks very, very different than sort of this fuzzball picture that's been proposed. So you'd like to understand the connection between that. I'm going to at least propose a possible connection. You can decide whether or not you like it or not. Along the way, we'll see that there's some interesting pictures with, I really shouldn't say quantum here because it's a classical geometry. Well, if you quantized it, it would be a quantum foam. So this should be space-time foam and some geometric transitions. And barring that for the gravity people, all these things I'm going to write down are going to be basically techniques to generate new, smooth, stable supergravity backgrounds, which are interesting in and of themselves. So the basic outline of the talk is pretty simple. I will give a short introduction and review to what the fuzzball hypothesis is, just in case anyone wasn't here this morning. Then I'll discuss something called the Benner-Warner ansatz. What this is building off of work done by a number of groups, including Gurkowski, Rial, and a bunch of people I'm forgetting, for basically finding general solutions that have three charges or 1/8 BPS and are in M theory. Then what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to solve the equations of motion for a three-charge system, and I'm going to have to make sure I satisfy various global constraints, such as lack of closed time-like curves, smoothness, things like that. Then I'm going to show how to reduce this to 2A. Basically, I'm going to place it in a Taub-Nut geometry, and I'm going to do the reduction. When I reduce that, there's going to be a connection to special geometry, and I'll display that. And then I'm going to introduce sort of what I call this novel scaling relation. What we're going to see is that this will have an interpretation in terms of some wrapped D-brains, and I'm going to introduce a scaling where basically by taking G-string large or small, I can move the brains closer and farther apart, and as the brains get closer together, it becomes more apt to describe this in an open string model, and it's going to turn out to be a quiver model, and I'm going to show that connection, and that's actually going to be how I connect this to the Strominger-Vafa picture, and then I'm just going to sum up and discuss. Okay, so the basic fuzzball hypothesis, just to review very quickly. So this is the old picture of a black hole. I have a singularity at the center, I have basically empty space, and then I have horizon. And basically all the interesting physics is concentrated at the at the singularity right here. The fuzzball hypothesis says is that's not true. What I have is a bunch of stuff going on in here. I have no singularity, I have no horizon. And the typical size of the fuzzball is about what the size of the expected black hole or black ring horizon would be. And you view the black hole geometry as basically being an emergent phenomenon that's arising from coarse graining. So if I take a bunch of these microstates and I regard them as some statistical mechanical ensemble and I compute the average quantities, that's where the black hole picture horizons. So each microstate is completely smooth and horizon free. Okay. So obviously I better make sure that each microstate looks the same asymptotically. Closer in, we're going to see these differences. In my case, in the M-theory frame, what will happen is basically where you thought you had this core region of a singularity, you're going to puff up into a very non-trivial geometry of basically two cycles. So I'm going to have basically bubbles all over the place. And there are going to be rules for arranging them. And sort of the intricate geometry of this foam will determine the difference between one microstate and another microstate. Okay, so here's the ansatz. This looks complicated, so let me sum up the basic points. So I want three charges, and I want it to be 1/8 BPS. And when I say 5D here, what I mean is that I'm going to reduce on a T6. So there's five non-trivial, non-compact dimensions. And all I'm going to basically do is wrap three stacks of M2 brains on the various cycles of the torus. So I just choose to make them orthogonal cycles. You don't have to. In this case, I'm going to choose this is one part of the torus, this is another part of the torus, this is another part, and that's how I'm going to wrap the brains. So the important parts of the metric are, you see there's a non-trivial time vibration here. This K is a one form. It will have legs in four directions. This thing I call the sigma direction, which is really tau plus some vibration, and then an R3, so R, theta, and phi. The other part is this is fibered over a hyperkähler base space. And this is actually not completely a hyperkähler space. This is what's called pseudo-hyperkähler. So what I mean by that is you see there's this H function. This will be some harmonic function. And I'm going to allow that to actually change sign. Now, normally this would be a problem because ds squared hk would flip from plus, plus, plus to minus, 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 minus. And that's normally a serious problem. So I have to make sure that these various warp factors, these z1, z2, z3 parts, are tuned in such a way so that everything is smooth and maintains constant signature. So I will make sure that that actually occurs. The hyperkähler space I'm basically going to write in the Gibbons-Hawking form. This is a specialization that's not necessary. Basically, by doing this, I've restricted myself to having a u1 invariance. The u1 is along this d tau direction. In the five dimensions, you can regard that as somewhat of a handicap because I'm not writing down the most general solution. In four dimensions, it's actually kind of nice because I want to reduce on this isometry to get to 2a. And then there are various equations of motion for this vibration. This is just basically a Hopf vibration. And here's it's basically saying that the curl of F has to be the gradient of the field. And this obviously comes with some flux, so there's a C field turned on. And the important things to notice about the C field is that there's an electric part here, and it basically has two legs in each of the torus directions. So when I reduce on T6, I'm basically going to get three U1 gauge fields. And then there are the magnetic parts, and again, I'll just have three magnetic fields. So it looks very complicated, but all it really is three U1 gauge fields and some geometry put over a non-trivial base. So the Banner-Warner ansatz, which I'm not going to go into, there's an entire paper on it, it's a talk in and of itself, is basically you define these Gs to be the derivatives of A, which are in the gauge field, and then from solving the Killing spinner equations, the Gs have to be self-dual. These z's have to obey this equation, and the self-dual part of k has to obey this equation. Looking at this, you might think that I can add an arbitrary anti-self-dual part to k that is in principle true, but what happens if you try to do that without adding corresponding pieces to these other functions is that you'll, in general, develop closed time-like curves. So there's another condition you have to satisfy. And then just notational purposes, I'm sick of writing absolute epsilon ijk. There are just various times when, for example, dz1 is something like G2 wedge G3. So to save myself time, let's just define this SIJK. Okay. So this is basically what we did in the previous paper. I'll go through it a little bit quicker than I have in previous talks. So I have eight harmonic functions. Let me say what each of these are. This H, which was what determined the hyperkähler base space, when I reduce to 2A, will look like D6 brains. In M3, it's basically the KK monopole. This M function will control the M2 brain charge. This little HI function will control M5 brain charge. When I'm in five dimensions, I'll have no net M5 brain charge. But when I reduce to four dimensions, I'll have D4 brains. This K will, in some sense, control one of the angular momenta in five dimensions. When I reduce down, it will basically be the D0 brain charge. So in general, I'll have eight charges. I'll have a D6 brain, 3D2s, 3D4s that are the magnetic duals, and then the dual D0 brains, which will come from momentum. An important part is that these poles are all lined up exactly the same. Now, in general, you wouldn't have to do that, but if you didn't do that, you would see that you would develop singularities in the metric. So that's why that has to occur. And then, I won't go into the details here, but just to display it, you can read off the various quantities that show up in the metric and the C field and such, just from these harmonic functions. So basically, once I specify pretty much these NP charges, where the poles are, and various, and these DPs, we'll see that this Q is built off this D, I can read off the entire solution. There's, of course, a song and dance in actually solving some of these equations, but it's really not too bad. So there are various constraints to ensure that things are smooth. So the first constraint is that not all these charges are independent. You find the M2 brain charge is related to the D5 brain, or sorry, the M5 brain coefficients. So is the angular momentum, and various of these constants have to be arranged. The details here are not important. They will be later, and I'll display it in a much nicer form later. But basically, there are various restrictions that have to be satisfied. The most important restriction that we'll have to satisfy is that this K form had better be well behaved. What I mean by that is, so Ka dxa, or sorry, d, so Ka dxa is some form, d of it is a one form, and d squared of it had better be zero, right? D of something better give me zero. If it doesn't, then it's saying that this form is singular, or I have to define my space in terms of patches, and I don't want to do that, because I've just told you there's no horizons, it's completely smooth, so I better make sure that that's, I can find some coordinate system where I can do this. So if you work out what this equation is, you take d of this side and you massage it a little bit, it will reduce to this equation. So let me explain what these variables are. This lambda is basically this coefficient for the M5 brain, and then there's a gauge invariance that you have to take care of. Basically, large gauge transformations need to be taken into account. So this lambda is the gauge invariant quantity. The d is not. And this gamma pq is basically the intersection number of the M2 brains on the torus. And so all it basically says is, as I change the charges, this will control, for example, the M2 brain and the M5 brain charges, I have to make sure that I move the poles in certain directions, that it's not completely arbitrary. Now, there's a little bit more to say here. There's a nice picture, so let me describe it now. Can everyone see if I write on this blackboard or no? Okay.
Far right side.
On the far right side. Okay. So let me go back to the metric. Okay. So you can see here that these things are going to live in the R3. All these are harmonic functions on this R3. Can you see this? Okay. And what I'm going to basically do is I'm going to place in pairs of poles. So here's one pole. Let's call this point P. And another pole is point Q. And I'm going to associate some NP and some DIP with it, and some NQ and some DIQ. Okay, let's draw the line between them. Now, the geometry here, if you look at this, there's this sigma vibration, right? And what that really is let's just look at the tau coordinate. And you'll see that when H blows up, right, the radius of this goes to zero. And when H blows up is when I approach one of these poles. So here, the radius is zero, and somewhere in the middle, it's non-zero. And so I basically can draw a two-cycle. It looks like a football, but it's basically a two-cycle. This is sort of the toric geometry way of defining a two-cycle. And so the DIP and the DIQ will, in some sense, parameterize the flux going through this two-cycle. So these constraints that I write down right here is basically the rules for arranging these bubbles based on the flux that goes through them. It's a little more subtle than that because, of course, I have three dimensions and I can worry about angles that they're arranged and such. But what I'm going to eventually get is some geometry where I have a bunch of bubbles like this, and that's what I'm going to call the fuzzball or the space-time foam. And this is just basically giving me the rules for arranging them. So is this clear?
How many bubbles can there be? Is known?
It's not known. From looking at this, it looks like an infinite number. I would guess that as you start increasing it very, very large, there must be some cutoff, but I don't quite know yet.
So these numbers are for two cycles in five dimensions?
Yes.
Minimum number of bubbles?
Yeah, you need to have at least one bubble. The one bubble solutions will be the spectrally flowed three charge solutions.
Okay.
So all of the previous three charge solutions that came from spectrally flowing from the two charge states, basically by just exciting certain, you spectrally flow and you excite the Raman sector on the, I think it's the left side, is that right? That gives you these very special, what I said, special three charge states. Those are all just these, basically one bubble or two pole states. Anything more than that will be a more general free charge microstate.
And these are the previous transmissions?
Sure.
So what's the meaning of this last condition?
This condition?
Yeah.
This is the rule for arranging these bubbles. So what it says is, this RPQ is how far apart each of these bubbles are. So this distance right here is what I'm calling RPQ, for example. So it's basically telling me is, as I add more flux in, the bubble wants to expand. As I add less flux in, the bubble wants to shrink, and so on. And then it's not that simple because it's non-linear here, right? There's this sum over Q. So there's a sum over points here. So it's the net contribution of all the other pairs that's not there. That's not that one point that matters. So it's a little bit, this is what makes it very hard to solve if you have a large number of bubbles. Yep.
So you constructed a large class of sequence solutions,
yes,
free charges.
Yep.
Parameterized by all these constants.
Right.
But this is still a small subset of what we expect, right? Because you don't have any free functions here.
Well, it's just, okay, so the free function here that you're thinking of would correspond to breaking the U1 invariance. But I have a U1 invariance here. The general microstate is not going to be U1 invariant. So what that would correspond to is not writing the hyperkähler space in Gibbons-Hawking form. Or if you want to think more generally, basically allowing these harmonic functions that I have to not just be a function on the R3, but to also have tau dependence. And that would break the remaining U1.
So there's an argument that these are the general solutions with the U1?
Yes. At least in the supergravity. Right? You can argue possibly that there are higher stringy corrections that might become important. But for...
I think it's too true that if you have a U1 symmetry,
yep,
a Gibbons-Hawking base has a U1 symmetry.
Yes.
It takes the 4D space and breaks it into 4D hyperfluids to U1 and then the rest.
Yep.
But if you just have a U1, it doesn't mean it's Gibbons-Hawking.
That's true.
Somehow
that's true.
It has to be compartment conditions with three complex structures and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. I'm not the expert on this. But
I think just having a U1 is still not going to be enough to put you in Gibbons-Hawking. So with U1, there might be yours.
That's true. So the way to find the most general microstate would be to write down the most general hyperkähler metric you could think, and then make sure that it's smooth and so on like that. And there's no CTCs.
Right, the option work of beta 1 is also in future. I'm getting into that much with, you don't want to suppose it could work with any arbitrary hyperkähler.
Yes, that's true. So we're specializing here just to make the equations tractable. Because if I can understand this system, we can worry about generalizing it.
We can understand the question that you already asked. Is there some reason to expect based on that?
So my understanding of this ansatz is that it's coming from, it's basically the growth of this minimal 60, right? The most general solution to minimal 60 supergravity can be written in this form, and this is coming out of it. So I believe the ansatz here is the most general ansatz you can write down that it's still 1/8 BPS and has three charges. Now, if I'm wrong about that, then no, this is not the most general thing. But assuming that assumption is correct, then I don't think of, in supergravity, there's nothing else to play with, right?
But Tony, I think that it's true that the most general graph is hyperkähler base space. But I think the question is, this is a hyperkähler space with a U1 symmetry, which is trihomomorphic.
Yes.
And I think there might be hyperkähler spaces where that U1 is not trihomomorphic.
I'm agreeing with you. I think that's different than what Don's at. If it is, then I'm misunderstanding your question.
I'm wondering whether there was an argument by comparing the brain gauge theory or something that was not an intrinsically supergravity argument that you could perhaps match up your solutions with states.
No. There's no such argument because I don't even know what the CFT states are that are dual Lewis things yet. If someone knows, please tell me. So let's just check a couple more smoothness properties. One way to avoid singularities, this is not certainly not a necessary, but it's a sufficient condition, is if my metric and its inverse is everywhere smooth and I think it's L2 differentiable, then I'm or C2 differentiable, then I'm basically okay. So I better make sure that this thing doesn't go to zero. I also better make sure that this thing doesn't go imaginary or blow up or something like that, because if it goes imaginary or it flips signature, that's a serious problem. So the easiest way to do that, if you compute the determinant, is you just require Zi times H greater than zero. This will actually turn out in one slide to be a redundant quantity, but this will ensure that you have no singularities anywhere. So let's look at CTCs. So the easiest way to avoid CTCs is I want to make my spacetime what's called stably causal. All that basically means is I need something called a time function, which is some smooth function whose gradient is everywhere time-like. So let's pick the simplest thing I can think of, which is the coordinate t, certainly a smooth function, well-defined everywhere. And you compute its gradient, and it ends up obviously just being minus gtt up, and it comes out to this expression. Now, in here, I'll later show this is the E77 quotic invariant, and then there's this little extra piece coming from the R3. We're not quite sure what this is yet. There's possible rumors this might be an E8 invariant, but I'm not going to go into that right now. And all you basically need to require is that this thing is greater than zero. The problem, of course, is that, well, the Ka are complicated functions. These are not the simplest functions in the world, and you have to check it everywhere. So for most of the geometries, this is a very, very complicated, hard thing to do. So in practice, what you generally do is you find some solution, and you check this at various points, and you hope it's satisfied everywhere else. To be honest, you really need to check everything. So we've thought a little bit about coming up with a good analytic argument for checking an inequality. Honestly, I haven't come up with anything good yet, but a couple of examples I've done, I've numerically checked in lots of places, and it seems to be well behaved.
Are there any examples of otherwise smooth solutions for this condition
failed? I do not know the answer to that question. Do you know of any examples where this failed?
Well, I haven't played with it.
Yeah. So let's try to think about that. Off the top of my head, I would say no, but my limited knowledge of smooth supergravity solutions that have closed timeline curves is not very high. Does anyone else know of any? Okay. And then if you massage this condition a little bit, you'll actually see that it implies CIH is greater than zero, basically because, well, this is the only positive thing, so this has to be greater than zero. And there's a further restriction that these Zs have to have the same sign everywhere. So, well, Z1, Z2, and Z3 all have to, when they flip sign, they all have to flip sign at the same time, and that's enough to imply this condition. And then, I won't go into the details of this, but if you want to avoid Dirac strings, you'll actually see that these coefficients in the various harmonic functions are quantized. That's basically coming from integrating around these small loops. So that's what you get.
I mean, a Gödel space-time, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Gödel space-time. There you go. Is that what you're thinking of?
Well, I was thinking more restrictively.
Certainly, some of these hypertube solutions that are built off of. Although I'm not sure those are completely smooth, right? There are these hypertube solutions that Eric and I think Petra Horjava have found that also have these properties. They have closed time-like curves, but I'm not sure if they're smooth everywhere. I think there's either a horizon or something like that. Yeah, that's an interesting question. We'll take it offline because I don't know off the top of my head, and it's not going to be very productive. So you can read off various asymptotic charges. It's not very interesting, but there's some M2 brain charge. The net M5 brain charge is zero. Since we're in five dimensions, the rotation group is SO4. That breaks up into SU2 left cross SU2 right, and it very simply gives you a J right and a J left. One thing I will point out is that this J right does not depend on the location of these bubbles. The reason for that is precisely this U1 isometry. If I were to break that U1 isometry, this would in general depend on that. So this is what's going to eventually become the D0 brain charge. Okay. So some general features. I already discussed these. So basically, I just have a bunch of regular two cycles. I'll call them SPQ. And the bubble equation, which was that restriction on K, tells me how to arrange these things. And the different ways I can arrange them give me all the different microstates that I could possibly write down. Now, you would have thought that I would have singular brain sources here, but in fact, I don't. What I have here is just flux going through these cycles. So there's already been a geometric transition done, and all my brain sources are just replaced by flux going through the dual cycle. So while I have net two brain charge here, for example, there is no M2 brains actually in the geometry. That's important because it smooths everything out. So the generic microstate will basically have a very large number of poles. There's various arguments you can make why you expect the generic microstate to have a large number of poles. One is, you expect the generic microstate to have lots of nearby states that look about the same. Otherwise, it's not a very generic state. And so, if you have lots of poles, it's much easier to jiggle one pole a little bit change the charge a little bit, and have it still basically look the same. Whereas if I have two poles or three poles, if I jiggle a charge or I change it, it's going to drastically change the conserved charges and so on. And then I basically solve these equations of motion and ensured smoothness. So this is all I'm going to say about the five-dimensional solutions. Let me talk about the more interest. Oh, sorry. One more slide about these. So all I basically have to do is satisfy these two conditions, and everything is fine. So now the reduction to 2a. So I can't just reduce to 2a blindly. The reason for that is that the circle in infinity is not finite. So I have to basically put this in Taubnut to make it finite. And all that basically means is I take my harmonic function and I add some constant to it. And the constant, for various reasons, I'm going to call 4 over L squared, where L is going to be the radius of the 11th dimension, and that's of course just G string times L string. And then you have to add various other constants to the 7 other harmonic functions. I won't display the details. They're not all independent. You basically have to make sure that your angular momentum at infinity is still finite, your C field still has good asymptotic behavior, and so on. And then you can just do the reduction. So the reduction is pretty simple. Let me, for use later, just define dimensionless versions of all these harmonic functions just by taking various powers of 4 and L. And what you basically get is you get some metric in 10 dimensions. You get a dilaton. I'll say what this J4 is in a second. You get a dilaton. This dilaton, while it looks somewhat complicated, is actually exactly what you want so that the dilaton in 4 dimensions is constant. So when you reduce on the T6, this is precisely, if you look at this ZI M0 factor, it's precisely what you're going to get with the right power of J4 to make it basically 1. Some of them had constants. These are additional constants. So the 6 brain and the 5 brain. The 6 brain and the 4 brain. So the capital H and the little h did not have constants. But the M and the K did in general. But I'm adding additional constants to those as well. So I have a B field, which is non-trivial, although it only has legs in the torus directions. When I reduce the metric, I get a C1 field, and when I reduce the C3 field, I just get some leftover C3 piece. The detailed form of these are not important, except for this J4. So this J4, if you work it out, actually turns out to be exactly the quotic invariant of E77. It looks like it's got this awful form, but I tell you this is actually something like Z1, Z2, Z3 times H minus K0 squared H squared. It doesn't look like it. You have to do a few pages of algebra. This is what you get. So the J4 is the quotic invariant of E77, and you also alter the bubble equation by adding these constants. So this is now important. So this psi p basically picks up an extra term because I now have a finite radius. And also what I'm calling lambda picks up a term because I have a finite radius here. But otherwise the bubble equation basically looks the same, except now that there's a 2 over L in front. J4 is the stuff that shows up as the warp factors in the metric and also appears in various places in the dilaton.
Tommy.
Yes.
Let's revisit this question about the hidden talking space for this context. You're down in 4 dimensions now.
Yep.
There's some classification of supersymmetric solutions in 4 dimensional algebra.
Okay.
Does that classification tell you that the 3-dimensional base of your integer has to be flat or a more general possibility?
In this onslaught, it certainly has to be flat. But I don't think forbids generalizations where the base is not flat. However, basically everything will be altered. Because if I make this not flat, it's going to source a different B field and C fields and so on. The dilaton might run in different directions. So it's going to introduce massive complications. I don't think it's just a simple change. Yes, I'm going to get there. Yeah. Basically, what I'm going to propose is, so these bubbles, these poles here, I'm going to propose that they're basically these building block atoms for making like a molecule that describes a microstate. And you can write down all the charges for a given point in terms of the E77 vectors. And so it tells you how to organize all the charges so you can very easily break up and describe a solution. So I'm actually getting there in about, hopefully, a couple of slides. So let me just read off. Okay, now there's a bunch of charges. There's some angular momentum, which basically reduces. But now I have D6 brain, D0 brain, D2 brain, and D4 brain charge. And they're all somewhat related because they all basically involve these Ds and these Ns. Now, If I look at the quartic, so the other thing that's useful about the quartic invariant is by computing it as a function and its derivatives as functions of various charges, like these Qs here, I can categorize the state as being 1/2, 1/4, or 1/8 BPS. What you will find if you do that is that each individual pole here is 1/2 BPS, but the aggregate is 1/8 BPS.
So these four-dimensional solutions have a non-zero angular momentum?
Yes, in general, although you can certainly find solutions that have zero angular momentum.
Right, so those with a non-zero one cannot correspond to my
mistake. Yeah, this is subtle. So I was just thinking actually about this morning. So what happens here is, if you look at the expression here, you notice this RPQ, right? When I coarse grain, coarse graining is going to basically be taking all these poles and sort of lumping them together. When I do that, right, this RPQ goes to zero because there's no separation of them. There's no dipole moment anymore, if you will. So in that limit, the J actually seems to vanish. So it's not completely clear yet how to include these things, whether the things with non-vanishing J when you coarse grain actually are still in the ensemble or whether they're not. So you seem confused.
Yeah, I'm confused, yes, because so you're saying if I settle the RPQs to zero, then J is zero.
Then J is zero.
But if I settle the RPQs
to be non-vanishing, then
J. Yeah, so that corresponds to getting control of the valve for itself.
Yes,
standards.
Yes.
So that's a unique state?
Well, no, that's not really a good microstate.
Right.
What I'm saying is the coarse grain state is, in some sense, looking at all, you know, I ignore the fact that there's all this bubbles going on, I just smash everything together. That would be sort of how I would coarse grain. And when I do that, then the angular momentum vanishes. So, in other words, I'm saying if you take microstates where J is non-vanishing and you coarse grain them, J actually flows to zero. So, I don't quite know yet whether or not those should be included or not.
Let me ask you a different question.
Sure.
You want to, you're associating in some sense the charge with each point P, which is just the contribution to the sum.
Yes.
Is there really a charge associated with each point P? Is there some surface I can draw? Is there some cycle associated with the point P where I measure this D2 charge, for example?
There isn't. So what I'm assuming, the way I'm doing this calculation, when I write these charges as being, so this is accurate. The net D6 brain charge is the sum of all these things. What I'm saying here is, if I look at one pole and forget that any of the other poles are here, and then take some circles in infinity, since here's an infinity, and calculate, I will then just get, you know, NP and drop the sums. So that's what I mean by each pole has some D0, D6 brain charge. Of course, there's no circle I can really draw here, because I'm always going to include other contributions. I can't isolate it. So it's in some sense a little bit of a dippy thought experiment, but I think the interpretation is okay.
Can I go back to the first question?
Yeah.
So the angular momentum J you get from this particular term you wrote there,
mm-hmm.
its value will be more like in charge product like N1, N2, or is this J more like a cubic N1, N2, N3? There's a J left and a J right in your 5D solution.
Yeah, it's not that. It's not actually that simple because this J depends on the pole locations, and so it adds in a very nonlinear way. So it's not. It doesn't scale in a very nice way. For example, I can write down solutions that by adjusting, if I move a pole from here to here, that can take JL from some large value to zero, exactly. So there are plenty of solutions, yeah.
So maybe I can rephrase my question in the five-dimensional side.
Okay.
So before going to delta, in the syntactically applied five-dimensional solutions, you have both a J left and J right.
Yes.
So if those are microstates of some supersymmetric black hole,
then you want J left to vanish.
Right. Otherwise, they should be microstates of the black radius.
That's correct.
Okay. So.
So you could argue somehow, and I'm not an expert on black rings, but I guess what happens when you reduce a ring with finite JL?
Right. So what we did was to put the ring on top of that, and then when you reduce, you get a black hole. But the problem is that you get singularity at the tip of the net.
So, but here I don't think we get a singularity.
No. So this looks to me like the microstates of a two black hole.
That's possible. Where with two black holes orbiting. That's entirely possible. It could be also the microstate for like a black hole and a brain. Right? If I have like a black hole and just a D6 brain lying around over here, that would also generate angular momentum. It doesn't have to be two black holes.
No, it doesn't have to be, but if you want something that's regular,
yeah.
From a financial point of view, you've got to put a black horizon around the six
brain. What happens if I just smear the six brain or I just turn it into flux? It's coming from a different direction. Would that do it?
Yeah,
that's be smooth but still be horizon free? Yeah. I mean, that's basically what I'm doing here, right? Because I'm just smoothing everything out, so.
Right, I'm saying if you want this to be a microcritical black object.
Then it's certainly two black holes. That's possible.
Could we come for it? I think what ends up happening is there are two charges. Let's take the 5D case for the symmetry better. So it's one charge, one item which is a big one, which goes like N1, N2, N3. And then there's the other guy, which is a smaller one, which goes like N1, N2. If you actually look at, let's say, the extremal black hole of 5D, it doesn't, the smaller one here, it's supposed to be exactly zero, and the other one can be non-zero in the situation of breaking the mass at all. But that smaller one is actually much smaller than the bigger one, because that's only N1, N2, and the bigger one is N1, N2, N3. So when you actually have a smooth horizon to something, in those situations, when you have BPS, 4 plus 1 day smooth horizon, you find the smaller element of the 1 day N1, N2 should be instead exactly zero. When you actually make microstates, you find it's not exactly zero. It can go anywhere from zero to N1.
Yeah, that's true. So, for example,
it's much less than the N1 and N2.
Right, so it should be submitting the classical limit.
But right, but I could certainly construct states where J is non-zero but much smaller than the charges. And in that case, he would argue that it's a good microstate for a single black hole. Right, if J is of order, say, you know, Q0, and the horizon or the other charges are of order, you know, Q0, Q0, QI, QI, all multiplied together and they're large, it's much smaller.
So I don't know about these solutions, but the statement I can make is for the black ring solution, not true that one of them is submitting with respect to the other one.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So you have to be careful. There are certainly regimes where J is not subleading and regimes where J is subleading. And so those will be microstates possibly for different systems. That's possible.
Right, but you were saying there's not a clear scale with the charges of these.
There's not. What I'm saying is that for given systems that I can write down, there might be some with, for given arrangement of poles, there might be some with J that scale that look like where J is basically some factor of these charges, and there might be one where J is some factor of only two of these charges. Both of those are possible. And so you can just be describing, they're microstates for different systems, which is okay. Right? One is the microstate for reduction of the black ring, one is the microstate for reduction of the black hole, and so on. I don't see any problem with that, do you? Okay.
So the quantum solution is all fixed?
Completely smooth, free of.
What happened where you had some nuts before in the five-dimensional case, you don't get a singularity?
You don't, as far as I know, get a singularity.
So you've checked that the dilaton you get in the 40 pictures and more
than that? The dilaton's actually constant in 40 pictures. Yeah, I'm going to do that in the next slide, I think. Yeah. Remember, the dilaton here, if you look at this dilaton, you stare at it, when you reduce to 40, it's reducing on the T6, and the factor that comes from the J4 and the ZI here exactly cancels this, and the dilaton's completely smooth. Okay, so now this will answer your question. So if I further reduce, these are basically solutions to n equals 8 supergravity. The u-duality group of that is E77. And these things organize themselves very, very nicely. So the three D2 brain charges, the D2Is, and the D6 brain charge basically transform in the electric 28 of this maximal compact subgroup. The three D4s and the D0s transform in the magnetic 28, and together they make up a 56 of E77. So by doing E77 rotations, I can generate all the charges necessary for the whole orbit of black holes within this u-duality. And I can basically write down a very simple charge vector. So this Q0, I'm going to write, I've dropped the notation, but this is the D6, this is the D2, there's three of these. This is the D0, and this is the D4. These are the magnetic, these are the electric. And then I can write down the whole sum of charge vectors. And so this tells me when I'm writing these centers here how to actually write down the charge vector. So I'm going to argue the atom here is this half BPS charge vector. Okay, if you work out the charges here, you'll see that this is half BPS. So I'm going to build a 1/8 BPS state out of taking little atoms of 1/2 BPS configurations and arranging them by these rules to get sort of this molecule that's 1/8 BPS. I can also define this symplectic product on E7, which is gamma P, gamma Q, and it just looks like this. Basically, I take this and this, and then I flip a sign, and then I take this and this, and then I flip a sign. And that actually works out to exactly be the intersection number divided by some constant, because we were stupid in defining it. It turns out that you can also think of the 8 harmonic functions in the same way. The one that parameterizes the D6 brain, for example, the H function goes here, and so on. And I can rewrite all the equations of motion and all of the constraints in this language completely. And so I can show that it's manifestly, I can just get to everything by E7 rotations. So now let's ask which black holes these could be microstates for. So the area of a four-dimensional black hole, modulo this angular momentum worry here. So let's just assume I'm either looking at small or zero angular momentum for now, is basically 2 pi times the square root of this J4 invariant computed on the charge vector. You work out what this is on the charge vector, it comes out to be this. And so an example of a black hole you can make is 3 D2 brains and a D6 brain, and its area comes out to be this. This can easily be done in these things. I can vary the charges and turn on. You can do more complicated things. I can turn on electric and magnetic duals. One thing to point out is that if you have 5 charges turned on, at least one of which is an electric magnetic pair, that's enough to generate the whole orbit of the E7 black holes, or these 4D black holes. And I can easily do that here. So I'm not saying I can, by doing E7 rotations, get you every microstate, but I can get you a microstate. If you give me a microstate, I can do an E7 rotation on that to map out a microstate for each of the black holes along that U-duality orbit.
But if we think of black lengths,
that's
not enough to get you the most general radical charges.
It is, but for each, it's not.
At the same time, getting all the charges
turned on. If you have 5 charges turned on with an electric magnetic dual, why not?
It's a, well, it's shown by the Thin-Rosen that you can't do it.
What do you need to get the most general?
It's an argument of whether you, when you, sometimes you're diagonalizing to pick out the number of charges you need.
Well, but for the black rings, the U-duality group is E6. It's not E7-7. So it's a different system.
But you want to, it's similar because you want to reduce down. I think that's a similar argument. So it's interesting that it looks like you can get everything, when from this point of view, you may not see it.
Well, certainly, as far as I know, the older arguments on black holes that were made by...
But they didn't consider that the charges.
I see. So that's entirely possible. And here I would argue that's the same thing, which is that I can find a given microstate for the given conserved charges, but it certainly is not every microstate with those conserved charges. So it's not just, that's what I'm saying, it's not just a simple E7 rotation to generate the whole thing. You have to do more complicated things. Okay. So a couple comments on BPSness. So normally we would have expected a 1/8 BPS solution to fall off like 1 over r to the fourth. Well, the J4 invariant falls off like 1 over r to the fourth in infinity. You can see this easily if I take the D2, 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 D6 black hole, right? The term looks like M0, Z1, Z2, Z3, where these are basically just these charge centers. And because they're all at the same center, I get a 1 over r to the fourth fall off. Here, that doesn't happen. My solutions will always be 1 over r. And that's happening because it's multi-centered. So, like as I said before, each atom here, each charge center is 1/2 BPS. And so it falls off like a 1/2 BPS object. So even though the aggregate is 1/8 BPS, it still looks at infinity like a half BPS object. Yeah?
I guess I don't understand what you mean. I mean, even in the first case, if you take the product of those things, you'll pick up the 1 over r term.
Yeah. What I'm saying here is that the subleading corrections in the half BPS case vanish. There's no 1 over r cubed term. So in general, there'll be a 1 over r and a 1 over r squared and a 1 over r cubed and a 1 over r to the fourth. For a half BPS, there's only the 1 over r terms. The 1 over r squared and so on vanish. So in my case, that also happens, even though it's 1/8 BPS. So that's the only point I'm trying to make. So a question arises, which I'll discuss a little bit in my conclusions, is, at least in supergravity, if I want a smooth microstate or a smooth solution that's 1/8 BPS, do I always have to build it out of 1/2 BPS atoms or not?
I'm confused.
Sure.
If I had 2 half BPS objects, they just had a 1 over r fall off.
Yep.
And I don't put them on top of each other, then surely I do have a 1 over r squared.
You do.
But you're telling me you have multi-centered solutions.
I have multi-centered solutions where everything has been arranged in such a way as to make it only 1 over r fall off.
But what does that have to do with the fact that it's built for the half BPS thing?
It might not. My intuition here is that because the half BPS things fall off like 1 over r, that I basically arranged everything so that the fall off is sort of... Certainly if I were to arrange things out of quarter BPS centers, that would not be true anymore. Even if I try to arrange cancellations, it would in general fall off faster. I don't know. This is a guess.
Right.
this is an artifact here of various constraints.
Yes.
So that knowing those constraints are where BPS.
Well, so this is the question I'm asking, because naively, if I try to write down a quarter BPS center, I don't know how to write that down so it's smooth. It seems to me that if you use this ansatz, you'll always generate half BPS centers. So a question arises, which is, are we missing some? And if not, why don't we hit those quarter BPS? Is there a good argument? Can you make an argument that if you have a center that's quarter BPS, it will always have a singularity or not? Is the question I'm asking.
If your goal was to find microstates out of all of the 1/8 BPS black holes,
sure.
Then as you say, the generic such black hole has these higher terms, 1/r, 1/r²,
yep.
So doesn't this suggest that in fact you are not finding microstates in the generic black hole?
No, because it's determined by the 1/r fall off of infinity. It's the leading term that matters for the conserved charges and such.
Right. You're finding some, none of your tools, right, look, it's true that you're teaching my microstates, right? It's true that your solutions have the same charges as
this one. Sure.
But I guess what you're saying is that your solutions differ from black holes, not just quote close to the horizon, but in fact at the very first possible order in infinity.
That's possible, yes. Yes, but certainly the dominant correlations and stuff will be dominated by the leading term, not the subleading term.
In particular, they differ even far enough away that in black hole case, they differ even in places where you can quote see hair on the black hole.
You'd have to actually do, we haven't done the computation yet, you'd have to actually do that. You'd have to throw a wave packet at it and see where it starts deferring. It might not be as simple as, I agree with your intuition, but I'm not quite sure what the exact answer is.
I actually don't agree with intuition.
Okay.
Because the only thing you require from the microscope is that they carry the same conserved charges.
Yes.
They don't need to carry the same dipoles, so they're not. If you take a straight from black hole, that doesn't happen. You know, it's
the 1/r everything here. But we know any microstate is not going to be stable. Yeah, he's right. Okay, actually, I disagree with my intuition and your intuition. David's intuition is better in this case.
It's far different than far away. I understand what you're saying. But I think we see that in the two-charge case,
yeah.
Right? Because all these super tubes,
yeah.
You know, have things you could tell at infinity. You don't need multiple moments. They're not the same as the straight case. So when Samir says they all look the same down to a pretty sphere, that's, I think, not, you know, it's ignoring all these sort of higher multiple moments that you can see at infinity.
But sometimes it's obvious the other way. The black hole has multiple moments.
Yeah.
In some sense, the dissolution lacks. Like a black hole.
Right. It's the opposite.
The intuition is, my intuition is the black hole seems to have extra structure that's not seen. Well, that may not be accurate, but maybe the wrong way of saying
it. It actually doesn't look like holes have multiple moments because the function that multiplies the gauge is not h, but h minus 1. So when you expand that, you get anything for five holes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just that they are all determined by a single quantum charge.
Yeah, in this case, they won't be determined by that quantum. Yeah.
It's just okay. It's not here. Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it is kind of strange that you just. Constraints turn out to enforce.
I agree, and I was surprised when this happened. But this is what seems to happen. And so this is why I'm going to ask the question, if you want to build a microstate, should you always use half BPS centers or not? I don't know. It's certainly an interesting question.
It's really only because you impose these smoothness constraints that has this problem.
Right, but even if I think if you had quarter BPS centers and try.
I
agree.
Not
yeah.
Solution to half BPS centers that didn't have this
problem. Exactly. Exactly. But the question is, the further question to ask is, if I use quarter BPS centers, are there constraints that I can find that this is still well behaved and smooth? Or is there some theory that you can, a statement you can make that if you use less supersymmetric centers, you'll always encounter problems? I don't know. That's why I'm saying it's an interesting question. Okay. So now let me introduce this scaling, which I think is kind of cool. So you look at the bubble equation, it looks like this. And I claim that if I take T, the radius and the coordinates and the torus, which are suppressed right now, and I just scale them by alpha, that this equation and the other constraints which I haven't displayed remains intact. If you work out with that, okay, so I've suppressed the fact that you're also scaling these dipole charges a little bit. You're basically scaling the dipoles by alpha as well. This equation remains exactly the same. If you work out what this is, I'm basically scaling the 11-dimensional Planck length by alpha to the 1/3. this should look very suggestive.
The DI have to be integers, right?
What?
The DI have to be integers.
No, the DI are integers in some units. So this works out to exactly cancel out those units. It's in terms of some torus volume and the D2 brain charge. That's the quantized charges do not change by this scaling. There's no problem there. I'm basically scaling the Newton constant, if you will. So let me interpret this scaling as rescaling G string. I can certainly do that. And I want to hold the volume of the 6 torus and obviously L string fixed in string units. Now, if you do that, I can reinterpret this as basically the separation of the poles, the rho PQ, scaling by G string. So as I scale G string up and down, I basically move these poles closer and farther apart. And these pole locations, in some sense, can be thought of as wrapped D6 brains. It's not entirely accurate, because again, there's this geometric transition, but I can certainly think of it that way. And so as we alter G string, I'm basically moving brains closer and farther together. Now,
before you go on,
yep.
You say the torus volume and LS, you just mean the torus volume?
I just mean the torus volume. I just mean I'm scaling L Planck, but I'm not scaling L string. Sorry. So now as I move brains closer together, obviously I have to worry about open string degrees of freedom. So let's worry about that. So when the brains get closer together, when they get basically within a string length, and I don't have it on the slide, but if people are interested afterwards, I can show you when that occurs, then I have to take into account open string degrees of freedom. And to do that, it turns out that I'll get a quiver theory. And let me tell you how to read off the quiver theory. Is everyone here familiar with what a quiver theory is? Or should I, let me explain what a quiver theory is. So what a quiver theory is it's basically some gauge theory. And so for example, let's say I had a U3 cross U2 cross U1 theory. Perfectly reasonable theory. What I do is I draw a 3 here, a 2 here, and a 1 here to denote the gauge groups, and then I draw a bunch of arrows between these things. And what the arrows basically mean is, this says that I have some field that transforms in the anti-fundamental of the U3 and the fundamental of the U2, and so on. So here's how to read off the quiver from the geometry. So every time I have a charge vector, that gives me a gauge group. Okay, basically each of the brain locations obviously gives me a gauge group. And the number that I write in there is basically U1 unless I can rewrite gamma p as some integer times another appropriately quantized charge vector. So I'll have some np here and some nq here and another one over here. To tell me how many bifundamentals I need, am I doing okay?
Yeah,
okay. I'll be done before 3:15. I have like 2 or 3 slides left and I'm done. To read off the number of bifundamentals up to some units, it's basically these intersection numbers gamma pq. So I read off gamma pq, and the sign tells me the orientation. So if it's plus, it goes from the p to the q. If it's minus, I draw the arrow the other way. And in general, I have some quiver. And that's how I read it off.
How does your geometry determine capital NP? I didn't get
it. Oh, okay. So I have some charge vector. Right, let me show you it again. It's basically, right, it's this thing of the D6, the D2, and then the D4, the D0 and the D4 brains. And they have to be quantized in some units, which I haven't written here, but they basically the integers have to work out, so you have integer numbers of brains. Now, what I have to make sure is, let's say I could write gamma p, and I could take out some overall integer from all of these charges, and they're still appropriately quantized. Then I get an NP there. That's how I read off the NP. If I can't, if for example only the D6 brain works out that way, then I have just a U1 there. Okay. Yeah. That's all well and good. Now, if you do the analysis and you write down the Lagrangian, you'll see that when the open string picture is first valid, I have a system that's on the Coulomb branch. There's a Coulomb branch and a Higgs branch. Basically because the chiral multiplet scalars, their masses are proportional to the brain separation. And what you'll find is there's a couple terms in the M squared. Okay, one of the terms is the separation of the brains, and that scales as I scale G string. The other term is something that's called the phase of the central charge of the brains. For all you need to know now, it's some number, and it comes in with a minus sign, and it doesn't scale. So when I first start out, The separation of the brains is such that that term dominates, and the m phi squared is positive. And so I'm on the Coulomb branch.
What's the criteria for the open string picture to be valid? Is that you have two centers and a straight line separation?
Yeah, so in most of the typical states you write down, all the brains are of the same order of separation. So it's like you have a cluster of poles. You don't have like a cluster of poles and a pole way out here. So assuming you have all of them relatively close together, then it's basically when you come within about a string length of each other. So I can work that out for you afterwards if you want to see what the correspondence is.
So what that means is that the fundamental map is even
light. Exactly.
But even if they are far away, you still have a U1 through some power theory.
You do. You do, of course. But I'm saying if you try to write that down, the masses of all the fields will be huge. Oh yeah, of course. But what I'm saying is when they're far apart, it's reasonable to describe them in terms of supergravity language. And when they come closer together, that's not reasonable anymore, and I have to switch to this picture. That's the only claim I'm making. No, because you're scaling G string down, so the Newton's constant is also decreasing. The metric and the C field scale in the appropriate way. The metric scales like alpha squared and the C field scales like alpha cubed. So everything is completely okay there.
So it's not like a closed string speaking straight to resort.
It's just the fact that there's open string degrees of freedom that I'm missing now that I have better take into account.
But are there? I mean, if you have a smooth manifold with no brain sources, it's obvious there are open string degrees of freedom, you have to limit them.
Well, there are brains in the system, right? So
is your curvature getting large when you do the scaling?
So I haven't worked out the complete scaling, but the Newton's constant scales with this. So I believe that it gets weaker in just the right amount, so that I don't think the curvature actually increases. You mean Stringer Einstein? That I don't know. Well, the deltan's constant, so it actually doesn't matter. So it doesn't. The deltan is just one. Oh, I see. Yeah, so that's something we should actually have to work out. I haven't worked that out yet. But also, as I'm taking G string weak, the brains are becoming more massive, so it starts looking more and more like brains and less like flux.
You expect the curvature.
Yeah. Yeah, that might be the statement. The brains are certainly getting heavier, so therefore you'd expect that. I think that's probably the answer to your question. So therefore I have to take into account these open string degrees of freedom. Does that answer your question, David?
Yeah, so I guess you're just saying that the membrane track of those two cycles are becoming right.
Yeah.
And you should include them.
Yeah, or I'm saying the open strings between the brains are becoming light, and I better include them in my description.
Yeah,
Yeah, I think the membranes are actually becoming heavy. Yeah, the brains are becoming heavy, the strings are becoming light between them. That's the correct statement.
Sorry, are these
collection brains or
D2? These are D6 brains.
Is it in theory solution?
Forget the bubbles. Take each of the points. Each of those points is basically I'm reinterpreting as a wrap D6 brain. It's sourcing D6 brain charge.
Right. So it's the bubbles.
The bubble. Okay. So if this is, let me explain why this is confusing. When you reduce to four dimensions, I've reduced on one of the directions of the bubbles. So there's no bubble anymore to see. Right. There's none of these two cycles anymore. The bubbles are only apparent in the M theory picture. I apologize if this was confusing.
Isn't that the point that links the membrane wrapped on the bubbles to the open string and start to the D6 ring?
Yes.
Right. There it is.
Yes.
Okay, now you've confused me.
there's membranes between the other records. Those are getting light because they're records.
Yes.
Small sizes.
Yes.
But then there are the anchor records.
Which are getting heavy.
Right.
Yes.
The ones that David was talking about were the ones on the bubbles which are between the records.
Right, those are getting light. Okay, now I understand your question. I apologize. Okay. It actually turns out to be a quantum mechanics. You can, because the brains are all wrapped, all that really matters is you can dimensionally reduce the Lagrangian to a d equals 1, n equals 4 quantum mechanics. And so I can rewrite the Lagrangian that way. So you can write down a full quantum mechanics here. So actually, I think I'd say this later on, but the full quantum theory here can actually be solved, at least in the simple two-center case and in a couple more complicated cases, you can write it down too. So as we further lower the string coupling, these scalars would become tachyonic. They don't really become tachyonic. What basically happens is that the theory moves from the Coulomb branch onto the Higgs branch. And then as I continue taking G string to zero, I basically just collapse all the brains down on top of each other. And I arrive at the old picture of Strominger-Waffa, which is, you know, some debrained ground state and all the different ways I can arrange them. So the claim I'd like to make turning this around, although I will give you a couple caveats, is that I start with some, you know, debrained ground state, and as I run up the string coupling, this thing eventually puffs up through a quiver theory in the Higgs phase to the Coulomb phase, then these 2A BPS particles, and then the 11D space-time foam, where I can now see that, you know, it's just these bubbles of flux going through them. So that's true. That looks nice. Classically, quantum mechanically, what really happens is I have some wave function, and for various parameters or ranges of G-string, it's dominated either in the Higgs branch or the Coulomb's branch or the closed string picture and so on. And the transition is smooth. It is not a phase transition in the technical sense. Nothing's going to infinity. Nothing's discontinuous. Okay? Now, a point to make here, there's a couple points, is the old sort of Strominger-Waffa thing, they separated out, you know, here's the degrees of freedom, the D1 brain, the D5 brain, and the things between them. I would argue there's a basis change that needs to be made here, which is to these half BPS centers, where I've organized the D6, D4, D2, and D0 charge, or if you want to do a couple T-dualities, it'll be the D1 and D5 charge, in such a way that everything is half BPS at each center. And that's the, I think, the most natural way of describing the system. Now, a caveat with this is that I have not shown you, and it is not completely clear yet, that if I start with a G string equals zero and I write down some D brain ground state and it becomes a quiver in the Higgs phase, if I then continue increasing G string, that will actually continue to puff out, or if, as Gary was saying, I'll just keep increasing the coupling and the thing will collapse in on itself. So I have not shown you that yet. I think you can make the argument that if you have a quiver without closed loops, that won't generate a superpotential, and then I can explicitly write down the potential and you can show that that expands out. If I generate a superpotential, it becomes harder because, well, for anything but the simplest closed loop quivers you can write down, I don't even know how to calculate the superpotential. Right? This is what Hanani and company are trying to do, but they can only do it for planar diagrams, for example. So I don't know the answer to that question. My intuition is it will puff out, but I have no good rigorous calculation there. So take it with a grain of salt. We're certainly aware of the problem.
You could not even come from D-brain graph
around. On the T6. Yep. So it's basically just, they're just one dimensional, they're just points. Well, this can be, I mean, for any given quiver, right, I can somehow reinterpret this as some single brain moving on some singularity of a Clavial. Right, this is just a different way of looking at it, I think. But certainly I can generate non-planar diagrams here. And my very limited... So I draw a quiver. So this quiver is planar. Where'd my chalk go? Sorry. No. I start doing this, right? This is non-planar. That's a non-planar diagram. I don't know how to deal with that. So if people know this stuff better than me, I'd love to talk to you about how to actually calculate these superpotentials, because I admit I have very little idea. And that's just my own ignorance. So I would love to hear more about it. So if people know, please come up to me after. We can discuss. So let me sum up. So we've demonstrated the solution generating technique for these U1 microstates in 5 dimensions. And we showed how to reduce them to 4 dimensions. I showed basically that I take what I thought was a singular core region, there's a geometric transition, and I've replaced it by these bubbles threaded by flux. So after the reduction, you know, the solutions can be easily interpreted as D-brains in 2A. They're candidate microstates for 4D finite area black holes, minus the caveat that David said. We looked at the scaling behavior, and that leads to a picture connecting these microstates to D-brain ground states. And I showed how it smoothly takes us from this quiver theory up to space-time foam. So some open questions. The first one we've discussed a little bit. So can all the microstates be written in terms of half BPS atoms or not? And if not, where are the other ones and why aren't they in this onsets? The overarching question here is, how do we invert our conditions? What I mean by that is I have a bunch of charges that are conserved that I can easily, if you give me a microstate, I can calculate the conserved charges. What I can't do is if you give me a bunch of conserved charges, I can't write down every microstate because the conditions are hard to solve. Everything adds in a nonlinear way, so it's hard. So some very clever work here because I just don't think brute force is going to do it for you there.
Can you have some sort of estimate for, say, for large charges or something like that?
So you can, but I don't have the estimate yet. So one thing we're thinking of doing is sort of a mean field limit here, where we take a large number of poles and sort of smear them all out, and everything becomes, so all the sums become integrals and so on. And so instead of having like NP each point, I have some N of X. And that system I think you can describe, but we've only done a couple pages of calculations on that.
So is it that these don't have a finite number of microstates for a given
number of microstates? Is it that these
I would think so, because as you keep adding things, it's going to be harder and harder to get the right conserved charges. Okay, so this is intuition, but at some point, if you keep adding charges, I don't think, first of all, it's not clear you can always satisfy the constraints. Those are always severely limited. And even then, it's not clear that for every pole number, you can hit the right number of conserved charges. So it's not clear that at 27 poles, for example,
you can hit a microstate for every one pole of black ring.
And so as
you increase,
it could be that as you reach 2,000 poles, that maybe there are a bunch of black rings that
are not accessible. But you don't get any sharp bound.
I don't have a sharp bound.
If I have charges.
No, because I have no idea how to invert these conditions.
Less than a certain number of poles.
No, that I don't have. Because this adds in such a complicated way, I just don't know how to do that yet.
So if you answer the second question, then you have potentially the answer to the first, I guess.
I would definitely have the answer to the first.
The right number of solutions.
Yes. Yes.
If only the first question has been raised again, let me try to restate, I think, the issue we discussed before.
Okay.
About the one over row term, which may reconvince Tommy of his original intuition. Which is just that if you look at the two-charge case, it's true that if you look at any of the microsites, they differ at leaving at sort of subleading orders in whatever R from the black hole solution because they have black hole orders. But as Amir discussed earlier, if you look at the generic state in some sense, it's very small black hole orders. And in fact, if I were to compute the generic state corresponding to a very large black hole, the dipole moment would be extremely small. There's some limit in which one expects the generic microstate to approximate the metric of a generic black hole. This is very different because you can put a bound which says that if you look at all, you can put a uniform bound across the space of how many solutions, saying that none of them come closer to a black hole solution than something, because there's a coefficient at 1 over rho squared, which is always 0, at a certain way regarding the solution, whereas it should be a 1 over 1.
Would that be because of the extra nuance symmetry which has been imposed, gives it a minimum magnitude?
It could be.
Certainly, if I'm looking at four-dimensional solutions, you can't make that argument, because the four-dimensional solutions have to have this extra U1 to reduce. So, I don't think that will save you here. But I need an isometry to reduce on to get a four-dimensional solution.
Well, I argue that the microstates of four-dimensional black holes need not be reducible to four-dimensional geometries.
Okay.
Which would have happened to this projecting also, right?
Sure.
I mean, if you make support even just a plane.
Sure.
Make it in a plane. It always has an angular momentum because you can't possibly cancel it. This came by the area of the loop or something.
So,
but if you make it for the loop, it's cancelled off completely. But see, if you put extra symmetries, you can start with some size.
So certainly also, if you were to coarse grain, what I mean here is just start ignoring the fact that these poles are actually separated, you would start picking up these extra terms. Right, it would start falling off like 1 over rho to the 4th and 1 over rho cubed. Well, yeah. What I'm saying is if I have a bunch of states... Okay. I think we're meaning different things by coarse... We'll take it offline. I know what you're confused about, and I think it's just what I'm calling coarse grading is different than what you would.
Just one more question.
Yep.
So this distance between the poles is continuous, right?
Well, it's not completely continuous, because it's subtle. So you know that the angular momentum has to be quantized in some units, right? And moving the poles around changes the angular momentum.
Right. So I guess my question is, do you, so also the charges on dipoles.
Exactly.
So do you have enough quantization conditions to guarantee that all these distances, which are in principle continuous, will actually be discretized? Because otherwise you have a continuous family.
Yeah, that you do, I think. You have, you can show that you have, so once I've quantized the charges, the G's and stuff, which I have to do based on just general constraints on the C field, you can show that that constraint condition puts N minus one constraints on N poles, and the remaining freedom is in picking JL, which has to be quantized. So that is.
Okay, so all the distances are fixed in terms of the other.
Yes, okay. Yes. So there you're okay. You don't have a continuum there. Okay, so the remaining points are these relations, basically, this starts looking, so OSV, right, Aghori, Strom, and Jervafa says that, you know, I can look at the topological string, and from that I can calculate the entropy of, I can calculate the partition function for black holes, and from there I can calculate the entropy for these 4D black holes. So, you know, there's got to be some connection here to what's going on in the topological string and the black hole partition function. You know, are these the microstates, and if so, what are their representations in terms of the topological string theory? I think is an interesting question. This stuff about the E77 group, you know, can we use this to generate more general solutions? So what I mean here is, so obviously just rotating the whole solution globally won't do it for you. That'll just take you to a microstate for a black hole with the mu dual charges. But I can think of doing an E7 rotation on each of the charge centers separately. Now, in general, that will probably take you to something that doesn't satisfy the constraints. But perhaps there's ways of organizing things that you can check that the constraints are always satisfied. So some general group theoretic property. And that could give you more solutions here. I don't know, but it's a possibility. The last thing was the stuff we were just talking about. So these quivers with closed loops generate superpotentials. And how does this affect our story? How do we calculate the superpotentials? Does it spoil this stuff blowing up from the Higgs theory, from the Higgs phase to the Coulomb phase, and so on? And if it does, well, then there's a problem with the microstate picture, because I can write down microstates that look well-behaved but aren't, and what happens there? It's something we need to understand. So I think that's it. I will end there.
There are a few more short questions.